The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists Annual Convention and Scientific Sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the Annual Clinical Assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Karen, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. Novel Anticoagulants is presented by Dr. Patrick Cullinan.
I'd like to use the SIM element as a transition into one part before my lecture, so if you'll humor me. I teach a course called FCCS, which is the Fundamentals of Critical Care Support, and the purpose of it is to teach critical care thinking concepts to non-intensivists. Is there anybody in the crowd right now that has taken the course? I see one, two. So just a couple of people, three. My ambition is to continue to do positive things with the ACOI, and they've been very supportive. And I was actually trying to get the course provided here, obviously as an additional expense, but it would be minimal. It would come with simulation training, which is why we're talking about it, and a textbook, a pretest, a post-test. And just show of hands, if it was a one-day course or a day-and-a-half course, would anybody in the room be interested in a critical care structured course? It would be much like ATLS, so I see some interest. Okay. Hopefully next year, if I can get this working, I'll see a lot of your faces in the class, and we can teach FCCS. Okay, with that said, we've all heard the expression, all bleeding stops eventually. What you really are hoping is that it stops before their heart does. I have zero disclosures, but I am open if somebody wants to hire me. Okay. I wasn't kidding. Okay. My objectives, I try to keep it very casual, and I think that the best way of teaching is to throw it out there. So if you have questions while I'm talking, just raise your hand. It doesn't have to be at the end, though both of us will take questions at the end. My whole purpose with my lectures are not only to provide organization so that as we're talking, you're kind of following along, which I think helps imprint the information better, but it's also to be references. So sometimes you'll see my slides. I'm not going to go through great detail, but the visual, you can go back to it and look at it. So we're going to discuss the different types of DOACs. When they originally came out, a lot of people referred to them as NOACs, novel oral anticoagulants. The preferred term now is direct oral anticoagulants, so DOACs. I would like to talk about the pharmacokinetics, and I know that feels very basic science, but it is amazing how the pharmacokinetics, if you can remember a couple of things, can help you clinically in the way that you manage them. And then discuss some of the treatment options that we have. And I'm embarrassed to say, when these were starting to come out, they were getting used more often. I saw several of these in the ICU, these bleedings with these different DOACs. And even the hematologists really weren't doing well with guiding us on how to manage the acute bleed. So because this is a primary care group talking about critical care, who feels comfortable now switching over to the DOACs away from Coumadin? Okay, so let me rephrase the question so I get a better feel. How many people still consider Coumadin their first line for anticoagulation? Wow, okay, that's great. Coumadin really is a rat poison, and we've used it forever. It's dirt cheap, but I think that the literature is clearly out there that Coumadin probably in some circumstances may be the best option, but in most circumstances isn't. And yet, if we never get used to using these direct oral anticoagulants, then we don't feel comfortable switching, and then we don't actually know how to manage the complications that go with it. I did cases, and the reason I did it is because I think these cases will look like a lot of your patients. And I think that when we can put a face or an image to a discussion, it actually helps you retain the information a little bit better. So our case one, we have a 67-year-old man, heart failure and atrial fib. He's at home, he trips, he hits his head on the table. That's not good. He's on Metope, Lipitor, and Dabigatran, or Pradaxa, which is a thrombin inhibitor, right? Oral thrombin inhibitor. Immediately, what are our concerns? This isn't a surprise, everybody knows it. Intracranial hemorrhage, right? If he needs to go to the OR, we need to have this reversed. He's got atrial fibrillation, but he's tachycardic, he's tachypneic, and he's got malignant hypertension. So we've got to process this information in a very systematic way so that we manage this patient effectively. We have to get that blood pressure down. We have to get him controlled, and then we have to image him to see what we need to do to help. So what are our priorities? Anytime you have head injury, will it worsen if he's bleeding and he decompensates? So you consider the airway, breathing, obviously. But the cervical spine, never forget the cervical spine. If he hits his head and it was a significant strike, he may have a head injury that, or a neck injury that we are not seeing an initial impression. And then the BP management. So while you're doing all of this, you can be multitasking and addressing his blood pressure either through, I would probably use a beta blocker, labetalol, a little combination drug, as opposed to hydralazine, which may accentuate his atrial fibrillation. We're going to come back and talk about each one of these cases on the backside, but these are just some of the initial first looks. 44-year-old male, past medical history, diabetes, obesity, hypertension, and a previous DVT. So this is actually a pretty common scenario. Relatively young, kind of overweight, and that's just what he is. So he's out riding his motorcycle, he crashes, and he's got a swollen, painful, tight thigh. He's on Norvasc, Pravacol, and Coumadin. I think most of us feel pretty comfortable about how to manage Coumadin, and we'll talk about that. Even though it's not one of the DOACs, I like to put them side by side so you can see how the management has changed. And even with even with Coumadin, how our acute management of life-threatening bleeding has changed over the course of time. So he's tachycardic, tachypneic, widened pulse pressure, appears to be hypovolemic, moderate distress, and here's the big things that I wanted you to take away. So he's got a swollen thigh. This could be a femur fracture. This could be a vascular injury, a pelvic fracture. But he's starting to have decreased sensation in that leg. And my fear would be, what is it? Yes, thank you. Yeah, so the nerves that are fed by these small little blood vessels that give you sensation are actually the first things that go during a compartment syndrome as the pressure's rising. So now he could have a hematoma, a compartment syndrome, may have to go to the OR for fasciotomies, and you've got to figure out how to acutely manage, stop the bleeding, and acutely manage him so that he can have a surgical procedure. So our priorities, limb salvage, right? So it's the typical ABCs, limb salvage, get a compartment pressure, and then the different imaging, contact your specialist. 25-year-old female, she has depression and a DVT history, and she takes a bunch of pills in a suicide attempt. It turns out it's Xarelto, which is one of our 10A inhibitors, and she's on Zoloft, but she's not actually bleeding. So now all of a sudden she's taken a bunch, she didn't injure herself, and she arrives and she's tearful. Do we have to be as aggressive with her in reversing what this process when we actually don't even know how many medications she took, how many pills, what its effects will be? What are our options? Okay. 71-year-old female. Heart failure, CABG, reduced EF, chronic kidney disease. This is a big deal because we can have people that have chronic kidney disease and they get acutely ill for some reason and their kidney function worsens. How does that impact us with their anticoagulants? Has abdominal pain, cramping, and lower GI bleed. I think we've all, raise your hand if you've seen the commercials for the lawyers. If you've had a GI bleed, if you had an intracranial hemorrhage, okay. So we're going to talk about what the literature actually shows us about a lower GI bleed. But I would actually say maybe that's a good thing, and you'll hear why in a little bit later. Currently on Zoloft, carvedilol, amiodarone, and atorvastatin. So these are pretty common drugs, right? I mean, we've all prescribed them. The interaction between these drugs and your DOACs are very important, and you can get an accumulative effect through the systems that clear. And so all of a sudden, what is the appropriate dose for your patient may actually be inappropriate based off of the co-medications that they're on. Amiodarone, carvedilol, and atorvastatin all affect clearance of your DOACs and increases the half-life. So you have to be very careful, and chronic kidney disease will affect it, especially if they have an acute decompensation. So heart rate 60, which may or may not be anything, meaning they're on a beta blocker, so you may not see the effect of the bleeding. Tachypnic, which always makes me nervous, and the new sepsis guidelines really focus in on tachypnea because our body's natural response acutely to acidosis is to breathe faster to get our pH improved. So when I see tachypnea, I put a red flag on that. Blood pressure, once again, widened pulse pressure, kind of marginal. So this GI bleed may be something or it may not be something in terms of their volume status. So what kind of tests are we going to look for and how are we going to manage this patient? This is the last case, and then we'll kind of get into some of the details that I think are going to be the take-home points. Case 5, 63-year-old male, past medical of hypertension, chronic kidney disease, and AFib, presents with chest pain that goes to his back. Uh-oh. What are we thinking? Dissection, right? Medications, he's on apixaban and carvedilol. Once again, you can get this accentuation of your 10A inhibitors with carvedilol. Not tachycardic, maybe because of this beta blocker, but he is profoundly tachypnic, and he has a widened pulse pressure, which makes me very nervous, and then on physical exam, you get a holosystolic. So when you're talking about an aortic dissection, you have your type A's and your type B's. Your type A's, I always think of it as from the aortic valve around the arch and distal, are surgical. So if this patient has to go emergently to the OR, how are we going to get this reversed safely and effectively so that the surgeon can do the procedure? The type B's are managed medically, but that doesn't mean that we're not going to want to reverse his anticoagulation in case we have complications with mesenteric ischemia as the aorta dissects. That's why I do this for my kids. So I put this up there because I think a picture is truly worth 1,000 words, right? Or whatever, how many ever words it's supposed to be. But I like looking at the intrinsic, extrinsic pathway and the common pathways and seeing where these various drugs cross over and hit the different points. And it helps me remember then, as I'm in the hospital or out of the hospital, what medications are linked together. And I'll show you more, but you can see the 10A inhibition, which is by the 10A or 10A inhibitors. You have dabigatran, which is a thrombin or a 2A blocker. And then your vitamin K, which hits 2, 7, 9, and 10. So let's talk about them. What are the DOAC classes? Well, currently there's two. There's the direct thrombin inhibitors, and there's the factor 10A inhibitors. Pradaxa is the only direct thrombin inhibitor, but it is the oral equivalent of leparidin or gatraban, which a lot of people will use in the ICU for hits, hit complications. Factor 10A, the three major ones are Xarelto, Sevasia, and Eliquis. The important thing about that is how they're renally cleared or not, and then their half-life and how they can be utilized, and we'll go into a little more detail. So once again, this is just an image that you can see how our 10As stack up, how our direct thrombin inhibitors stack up, and where they cross in our extrinsic and common pathway. So dabigatran was approved for non-valvular AFib, DVT, PE prophylaxis and treatment, and that was novel. I remember when it came out and the fear was that rise in intracranial hemorrhages, and I'm telling you, the commercial started the next day for the lawyers. It was amazing. Well, of course, it's very scary when you don't have an antidote for a drug, and nobody knew how to manage these. And so if you did have a small head injury but you bled in your brain, that was a life-threatening problem. The pharmacokinetics, long half-life, excretion is 85 to 90% through the kidneys. Why is that important? Because if you have somebody with chronic kidney disease and they have an acute insult, that means the half-life's going to get even longer. But what does that tell you about the potential treatment strategy if I'm telling you that 90% get cleared through the kidney? Dialysis, right? Whether it be CRT or intermittent. But that's important, right? So this is how the pharmacokinetics helps us figure out what treatment strategy we may be able to use. I already told you it's a direct thrombin inhibitor. Therefore, a thrombin time would be the way to measure it. I wanted to say one thing, which is this is a big take home. If you have a patient who is bleeding and they're on one of these drugs, I do not care what the test says, okay? You treat them like the drug is present. If you have a patient that is not bleeding and the test is normal, you feel much more comfortable that the drug may not be present. So if the patient can't tell you when they took their drug last, their pill last, they're not actively bleeding and they have a normal thrombin time, then I may be much more comfortable sitting on them and not managing it other than expectantly. There was 5 trials, over 27,000 patients comparing the direct thrombin inhibitor, Pradaxa, to Coumadin. And it showed that there was an improvement in all the major categories, lower 30-day mortality, shorter ICU stay. And the one thing that kept popping up was a higher GI bleed. And so once again, the commercial starts. Did you have a bleed when you were placed on this? Well, it turns out, when they went back into the literature and looked at these patients, it turned out that they were identifying polyps in the colon. And so this actually may have been a good thing because they weren't getting their colonoscopy clearly at 65. They should have already had it. And so they were identifying cancer that would not have been there anyways. So I think that that is a take home that you could share with your patients, which is, I think this drug is safe, effective, it's demonstrated improved outcomes. However, you may have a GI bleed, but when it occurs, we can fix it. And in addition, it may actually assist us in diagnosing that you had a problem earlier. Lower risk of major bleeds, fatal bleeds, and intracranial bleeding. So despite all of the commercials, they're actually not accurate. So factor 10A inhibitors, I highlighted, if you look at the names, and I struggle with the English language, so saying these words are hard, but if you look, the 10A is in the name of all of these drugs. So that's an easy way to remember if you forget what they're on, how to know which one. So you have one direct thrombin inhibitor and you have 3 that are 10A inhibitors, and it's in the middle of their name. I want you to look at the half-lives and I want you to look at the excretion. So the kidney excretion is pretty low. So you can see that a strategy for removing these drugs is not going to be renal replacement, whether it be intermittent or continuous, right? This is going to be a drug that you use other methods. However, because it's not cleared through the kidneys, it's not surprising that the liver is a major clearance. And what's the number one cause of liver failure in the U.S. nowadays? And it's not alcohol. Fatty liver, NASH, right? So our diabetic, hypertensive, obese patients end up with NASH. So if they're starting to have problems with their liver function, these drugs then can build up. And that's a big take home. Factor 10A inhibitors. So an important point, PT, PTT will be abnormal, but they are not linear. So all it tells you is, yes, the drug is present, but there's no correlation to how long it is and how much of the drug is present. Now, we looked back at the intrinsic and extrinsic pathway and how the 10 and 10A is the cross point into the common pathway. Why that's important is that many of the larger hospitals will have anti-10A levels. And when we were using enoxaparin for our treatment in our ICUs, we would actually measure anti-10A levels to gauge our dosing, because many times their renal function wasn't appropriate. They were third spaced and they had a lot of edema, and we weren't quite sure how it was clearing. So we were following the anti-10A levels. So if your hospital has it, it is a good test to do. Once again, though, if your patient is bleeding, I don't care what the test says, treat them. And the big take home here is that Eliquis, because it is a shorter half-life and it has the lowest renal clearance, it is the only one that's FDA approved for end-stage renal disease. So that's a nice little pearl. So our treatment options, I put them side by side so that you can see how they cross over and how they are divergent. So Coumadin, we all know vitamin K, whether it be IV, sub-Q, or PO, but it can take a while. It can take 8, 10, 12 hours, even up to 24 hours for it to start working. So if you have a life-threatening problem, that it's not your answer. Many of our patients have heart failure, and the volume that goes with the FFP in the cryo can be too much for them. If you have an intracranial hemorrhage, the recommendation is PCC, prothrombin complex concentrate. It's a lower volume, it's highly effective. There is a 3 and a 4 factor, but the neurocritical care literature clearly shows that PCC in life-threatening bleeding is your answer. It is not FFP in cryo. And then you have factor 7. So when I talked about the 3 and 4 factor, the one factor that's missing in the 3 factor is factor 7. So there is literature that shows that you can use some factor 7 along with the 3-factor PCC. I think most hospitals are beginning to move to the 4-factor, but it is a little more expensive. So if you use the 4-factor PCC, you do not need factor 7. Remember that factor 7 is associated, if you have arterial injuries, with thrombosis. It's associated with thrombosis regardless, but when I have vascular injuries, it seems to enhance it. And I think it has to do with the expression of the endothelial layer in the vessel. When I was working in a cardiovascular ICU in Washington Hospital Center, which is 10 miles away, we did about 2,000 open hearts a year, and occasionally we would get these patients coming out of the OR coagulopathic. And we did use factor 7, but we occasionally had a bad outcome. Moving to the DOACs. So I don't know if any of you knew that charcoal actually binds these, but this is a nice little tidbit. It's cheap. It's relatively easy, as long as you don't think they're going to have to go to the OR. And they need to be intubated. So when we get to the 27-year-old woman that was a suicide, this may be a first-line step for her. You put the charcoal in, 1 gram per kilogram, and you do some observation on her. PCC can be used on both sides, vitamin K, Coumadin, or with the DOACs. And then you have the activated PCC. Both of those are the preferred, but I want you to see down there that factor 7 and FFP are not on the list of DOAC treatments. And that's where the confusion gets in, is that when you start getting into these very complex drugs and their dosing, they're not effective. And I've seen factor 7 doses get given over and over with zero stoppage of the bleeding. Back in 2015, so it's coming up on 2 years, Pradaxa actually then created an antidote called a Proxbind. And so it is a direct antidote for the thrombin inhibitors. It does not work for 10As. So it's specifically for Pradaxa. And then antifibrinolytics, whether it's DDAVP, tranexamic acid, or Amicar. But remember that Amicar has a huge volume. So you run it over 24 hours, 18 to 24 hours, and it's a large volume with it. So that's probably not the one I would use if I had heart failure problems. So let's quickly run through these cases. I'm not going to read them all, but when we look at these, This first one was our intracranial hemorrhage after the fall. He's on dabigatran, so that immediately tells us that we have proxbind as an option. We're concerned about intracranial hemorrhage, and one of the main things that we can do is blood pressure control. I probably would not utilize charcoal, recognizing that during the intubation you could have an issue. And PCC or K-Factor or K-Centra, I try to give you both brand names and generics so that you know, but K-Centra would be the way I would go. And I probably would throw on some tranexamic acid if he had a large intracranial hemorrhage. Okay, so this was the one we were worried about, the compartment syndrome. You guys were right on the money with that. Fasciotomy is my concern, so we have to prep them for the OR. What are our treatments? Vitamin K or PCC is really what I would do. You can give the vitamin K IV. There is a small risk of an anaphylactoid-like reaction. I do it all the time. I've never seen it, but it is in the literature. But remember, it's 8, 10, up to 24 hours before you get a reversal. And since you already know that he's got a swollen thigh, maybe volume isn't your answer, so maybe you wouldn't want to do FFP with a large volume. So I would do the PCC 4-factor. And then you can get away doing the factor 7 and antifibrinolytics, but remember that if there's a vascular injury, so it's not just muscle or a femur, but if there's a vascular injury, it's an increased risk of thrombosis in the artery, which would be a limb-threatening problem. Here's our young lady with the overdose. She looks pretty straightforward. I'd probably put her into an observation. I would suggest using charcoal because it's easy. If she then developed any ongoing problems, then I would look at the PCC. We have our elderly woman, CABG, EF of 30%, chronic kidney disease, and she's got the GI bleed. So this is one, you're most likely not gonna get a GI specialist to come in and scope her. So our job is to supportively manage her. I would probably use charcoal on this one. And proxbind because it will actually go and physically bind. And then the 4-factor. You can do CRT hemodialysis once again because it's so renally cleared, up to 90% of it, and that would not be a bad option. Now we have chronic kidney disease and AFib with an aortic dissection. Our concern is that it involves the valve because we're hearing a murmur. And we know that this is potentially a surgical case because the type A's get treated immediately if able. So this is one I may pause on the charcoal, right? If we really think that he's gonna go to the OR for surgery, I probably would not use it, but I put it in there for thoroughness. The PCC 4-factor or the activated PCC, which is utilized predominantly in hemophilias A and B with inhibitors, and it allows you to get around the inhibition. And I would be using the antifibrinolytics, probably on this one, tranexamic acid, because it has the best literature, though DDAVP is quick, easy. It has a tachyphylaxis to it, so you're really gonna get just the one dose and be done. So I hope nobody's offended by that, but It's been a long summer in Texas, and that is kind of the personality down there. So we're going to quickly go through the questions, and don't shout them out. I want you to think about them. I did try to make them a little trickier. So all of the following are recommended for the management of DOACs, FFP, PCC, Factor 7, all of the above. Pause. Okay. Which medications have been found to increase the dabigatran levels? Amiodarone, atorvastatin, carvedilol, all of the above. I think I mentioned that on one of the slides. And then hemodialysis is effective means of removing the following drugs. And I think we discussed that throughout. So the question, the first one was PCC, not FFP, not factor 7. They all, amiodarone, the statins, and carvedilol all affect clearance, increasing the drug. Hemodialysis, remember it's only the direct thrombin inhibitors that get cleared, and it has to do with the pharmacokinetics.